Yeah, okay, I've been asked to kick off today's discussion session. My particular area of interest is dynamo action in incompressible convection. That's what I'm going to be focusing on today. I should say that I can't promise that our subject material will sort of mesh in seamlessly, but hopefully there'll be enough sort of relation between those sort of three talks to make it a sort of a coherent session anyway. So that's the plan. Okay, so why are we interested in this kind of thing? I don't know how well this shows up actually. Is it reasonably? That's better. Yeah. So obviously the motivation for this is primarily observational. So if we look at the surface of the sun, so what I've got here is an image taken from Hinode's website. Perhaps focus, I mean, I'm not going to talk so much about the chromospheric stuff, but if we perhaps focus on the G-band image, which shows convection at the photospheric level at the surface of the sun, what we can see, again, it's not massively clear, what we can see hopefully is that we've got these broad the bright upwellings, and this is surrounded by a dark network of cool and narrow downwellings. They've got this granular pattern, and again, I'm not sure how well it's going to show up, but if you squint at these dark intergranular lanes, what you can see is they're permeated by this sort of ubiquitous collection of bright points, which sort of seem to sort of swim around. I mean, perhaps I'll try and highlight a few. Perhaps a good one there, perhaps a bit big, but you can sort of see it there. Let's play this again.
How long is this observation?
So you've got minutes here.
Minutes.
Okay. So I guess a convective turnover over time is about 5 minutes, that's the idea. Okay, so what are these bright points? Well, these are regions of a localized, very intense magnetic flux. And if you were to look at a co-spatial magnetogram, you'd find we've basically got this mixed polarity collection, so there's lots of pluses, lots of minuses. And as theoreticians, what we want to know is basically where do these things come from? I think it's a particularly interesting question, because if you actually measure the strength of these features using the Zeeman effect, you find that we've got features which often have field strengths of well in excess of a kilogauss. And why is this interesting? Well, if you've got a kilogauss strength magnetic feature, and if you look at the magnetic energy density, then that's actually an order of magnitude larger than the kinetic energy density of the surrounding convection. So I think it's a surprisingly strong accumulation of field that we actually have. So there are two possibilities. Either this flux is being reprocessed by the convection zone, it's sort of being generated or sort of fragmented from other regions within the area, and it's just popping up from deeper regions, or, and this is what I'm going to focus on today, it's being generated locally by small-scale dynamo action. So that's the other possibility. So I guess you may have already seen this already in this program, but I just want to give a little bit of background here. So when I talk about small-scale convectory-driven dynamo, what I'm talking about is a dynamo with no rotation and no shear. So it's in some sense very different from the kind of thing that people do with, say, the ASH code, where they've got these large spherical calculations. And almost universally, when people do these things, they talk about local boxes. So you know, if you think of a sort of shoebox or a biscuit tin, however you like to view these things, that's basically what we're going to be talking about today. So this is a pretty formidable problem. I mean, to get dynamo action, you need really quite large values of the magnetic Reynolds number. And it's obviously can burn up quite a lot of computer time doing this sort of thing. So it makes a lot of sense to try and do as simple a problem as possible. So, I mean, a very good place to start is what Fausto-Catania did in the late 90s, which is look at Boussinesq convection. And so what he took was basically a convective state in a horizontally periodic Cartesian box, fixed the Reynolds number at about 200, put it in a C magnetic field, and basically let it evolve. What I've plotted here, or what he's plotted here, is basically kinetic energy and magnetic energy against time. And what he found, that provided Rm is large enough, so for a large enough magnetic Reynolds number, in this case 1,000, he found really quite an efficient dynamo. So again, you can see it goes through a phase of kinematic growth, nonlinear growth, finally saturates to a level that's about 20% of the final kinetic energy.
I
think it's probably thermal diffusion time in this case, yeah. But it's still, I think, pretty rapid. I mean, it's quite an efficient dynamo. We've got quite a nice dynamo, and you can see if you look at the spatial structure. So, I mean, this is just temperature at the surface. This is vertical magnetic field. Plus or minus gives different signs of field. And this is BZ in the middle layer. If we just focus on this middle plot for the moment, you can see we've basically got a nice conglomeration of mixed polarity magnetic flux, which accumulates in, I guess, in the terminology of convection, you'd usually call this a mesoscale sort of cell. So it sort of accumulates at the vertices of large granules, essentially. So more recently, obviously the Bousinesq case is now, I guess, reasonably well studied, but what is much less well studied is the case of compressible convection. This is a very recent calculation carried out by Vogler and Schussler, where they take basically a simulation of convection in a compressible domain with radiative transfer. And again, what they found is, provided RM is large enough, we've got those three runs here, plotted magnetic energy against time, provided RM is large enough, again, you get quite an efficient dynamo. Whether run C is fully saturated, I don't know, but it's certainly pretty close. So, I mean, I've got certainly a pretty convincing dynamo there. So Prandtl number is magnetic Prandtl number, so that's very difficult to define, because this is a large eddy simulation. So what they have is basically an artificial viscosity. It's probably one. Yes. 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 I think I agree with that. So.
It's slightly larger than one. I mean, in MRI simulations where everything is being done by great viscosity and resistivity, they find that the effective
number. Yeah. I think that's fair. It's certainly not a low magnetic Prandtl number dynamo. I think that statement could certainly be made. I think the same is true of the Faraday's calculation. Magnetic Prandtl number there is 5. So as we'll see later, this it's perhaps rather difficult to relate directly to the photosphere, but perhaps we'll sort of make comments about that later. But the point is that this is large eddy. So they have all these artificial viscosities, which do make these things quite difficult to define. So what I've tried to do...
What's the level of dynamic energy? It's a very crucial thing to me.
I tried.
Very strong dynamo. Is it over the partition?
I don't think they give...
The partition is level 14.
I'm not sure they give that information, but perhaps they do. No, I don't think they do.
I think it's not super equipartition.
No, it's certainly not. No. It's still a reasonably efficient dynamo. Okay, so what I've been doing is basically looking at the other possibility, which is to say, well, can we do anything with direct numerical simulations? So rather than put in artificial viscosities, you know, that kind of thing, you know, can we basically resolve all our scales and still get a dynamo? And this is an interesting question. Obviously, make a trade-off here, because by doing DNS, you very much limit yourself to the sort of Reynolds numbers you can actually get to. You can't explore these sort of large, very large Reynolds numbers. You have to restrict yourself to much more modest values. But it does have the great advantage that we can be much more explicit about what our Reynolds number is, what our magnetic Prandtl number is, and so on. Hopefully these equations look pretty familiar. So these are basically the equations of compressible MHD. So density rho, momentum density rho u, magnetic field B, temperature T. So that's all, I hope, fairly standard. I quoted this in non-dimensional units. So there's all these kappas and zeta naughts floating around, but don't worry too much about those at the moment. So I'm not going to talk about these particularly. I'm just using those for convenience as much as anything else. So what else have we got? So we're going to integrate these equations in a horizontally periodic Cartesian domain, which I've shown here. So it's lambda by lambda by 1. I've said bottom lambda is typically 4 or 8. For the purposes of this talk, it's always 4. And obviously, these boundary conditions need consideration. What I use is highly idealized conditions at the upper and lower surfaces. So I assume they're impermeable, stress-free, vertical field, and fixed T. So in that sense, it's a pretty idealized photosphere. I think that's probably fair to say. But you know, as a sort of model calculation, it's not too bad a thing to do. Okay, so in keeping with...
What is M?
M's the polytropic index. Yeah. So perhaps I'll just mention these briefly. So theta just measures the thermal stratification across the layer. What else have we got? Sigma is the Prandtl number. Probably something else. But zeta naught is the ratio of magnetic to thermal diffusivity. So those are the basic parameters. Okay, so in keeping with what other people do, I basically take what is initially a fully developed hydrodynamic state, in which the density and temperature vary by about an order of magnitude across the layer, and then put in what is a very weak seed field. So I've not defined epsilon here, but the initial magnetic energy is really tiny compared to the kinetic. So there's a very well-defined kinematic phase at the start of each calculation. I should perhaps say that I'm going to be talking about this in more detail at the workshop at the end of the meeting. So I'm going to focus on today is perhaps the broader issues rather than the sort of specific aspects of these results. Okay, so I don't want to say too much about the numerics, and you can all read the details there if you're interested in that kind of thing. But I do want to say something about these parameters. So what I've done is I've listed the parameters that I use in these calculations. These are here, I list some estimates for photospheric values in these brackets. So, I mean, hopefully a very quick glance at these will convince you very quickly we have a serious issue in terms of matching photospheric values to.
We're having a problem with the recording, so I was wondering if you just mind pausing for a second.
Okay.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're getting double in this.
Okay.
But we'll start it again. Go ahead and start.
Okay, that's fine. back to slide one, I guess. That's a gamble, isn't it, I suppose? Yeah. What we have here is basically a Rayleigh number, which is the sort of standard measure of destabilizing effect of temperature relative to viscous and thermal diffusion. It's quite large, and it's 4 times 10 to the 5, 300 times the critical value for the onset of convection, but it's still 10 orders of magnitude too small. So, I mean, we're not exactly close in there. Similar problem with the Reynolds number, really quite a modest value of RE, 150 as opposed to 10 to the 12. We're slightly better with RM, so by varying the magnetic diffusivity, we can vary that between 60 and 660. Again, it's still 4 orders of magnitude too small. Prandtl number is a disaster. Sigma is 1 as opposed to 10 to the minus 7. And PM, by varying RM, obviously we get a similar range, but again, it's still miles out. So I think even the most optimistic theorist would say that this probably isn't what you class as a sort of good estimate for photospheric convection. I think that's probably a fair thing to say. Okay. So moving on to some results. So given the complexity of the problem, it makes a lot of sense to start with what is the kinematic problem. So turning off the Lorentz force, we basically get a situation where, depending upon RM, we either get exponential growth or exponential decay of our magnetic field. So again, I'm not sure how well this comes out, but what I've plotted here is growth rate against this axis against RM. Growth rate of zero is here, so it comes along like that. And what we find is that for this particular setup, critical RM is approximately 300, give or take. For values of RM that are close to critical, it's quite difficult to get an accurate assessment of the growth rate because there's sort of strong fluctuations about the mean. But I think 300 is really quite a good estimate, so that's okay.
300,
yes. Well, so magnetic Prandtl number here will be about 2 for 300. Yeah, because Reynolds number is 150.
The
definition
of magnetic number includes T5 or not?
No.
What's the level of compressibility?
Sorry?
What's the level of compressibility?
So temperature and density vary by one order of magnitude across the layer. Not huge, but it's sort of big enough to make a difference to the results. Yeah.
So, you know, I would like to stress that we calculate many years before this, to guys over to Catania, in 1997, and we find this number similar to you. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay. Very interesting. Yeah. What we see here is basically the growth rate does appear to be converging at large RM. Probably just worth stating that, but I have my doubts as to how important numerical diffusion gets by this stage. I mean, I think probably that's beginning to play a role. I've done a couple of high resolution checks, and I think that's probably an underestimate of the growth rate for this sort of value. So I think that's probably worth stating. This plot, I've not actually checked that yet, so that's something I can perhaps do.
Typically starts off as 1 and then goes up to 0.5.
Right.
And it's nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was worried about the range of values I had, so whether it would be sort of possible to get a convincing range. But I mean, there may be enough of a scale here. I mean, there's one order of magnitude between the smallest values and the largest, so it could be there's enough there to say something meaningful. Another way of looking at this has already been alluded to. Is we could view this as a growth rate against magnetic Prandtl number. And the magnetic Prandtl number at RM crit is about 2. And anything to the right of this line, so any of these values here, all have values of PM which are larger than unity. So they're all high PM dynamos. And as has already been mentioned, there is a certain amount of debate regarding the viability of whether these things can operate in a low PM regime. If you recall, the value in the solar photosphere is estimated about 10 to the minus 6, so the value of 2 is a little on the large side. But what I would say is I think at present, and probably for the foreseeable future, direct numerical simulations really can say nothing about this debate.
This is gamma for
magnetic energy, yeah, growth rate, yeah.
Could you try to put gamma for b squared, b cubed, b?
Not yet, no.
Check it.
Yeah.
You might get different numbers.
Okay.
Divide and proper.
Sure, normalized.
Number of moments.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting piece.
Okay, yeah.
Explain your pictures before because you get into the intermediate.
Yeah, okay.
That's exactly easy. But they can check it straight.
Can you explain what you're
saying? The energy, say, growth is one growth, right? The force moment can grow with different growth, right? Sixth moment, the average will grow. Because intermittency means the high moments are overtaking the low moments. If it's true.
I don't think that's true if you have an argument.
But what I suggest is to check. You just calculate growth rate for different things. For one, you calculate, say, for B, B squared, B force, everything.
Okay, yeah, it's worth looking at. Yeah.
You can do it tomorrow.
Yeah, probably could.
The second measure is not roughly the same, and I think sometimes I look at the plot line. So I also have a problem with the different.
If they're not different, then you're not supposed to have intermittency. That is previous picture.
This is kinematic.
Real kinematic.
For what? Yes, okay.
So it's still
getting
differences between harmonic
moments.
Like you've got some kind of
nonlinear
effects coming in.
No, not necessarily. It's kinematic. I'm aware.
But it's not stationary growth. In what sense, 1885, do velocity feel totally non-stationary? 1885, the situation is a little bit strange.
No, it's statistically. Waits, he gets his convection, he then puts in a magnetic field.
If you got eigenfunctions,
yeah.
Then maybe you forget about it.
You're
dealing with different things. Okay, if you have stationary eigenfunctions, then it comes to the same.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But if you have structures, which disappear. I was confused by previous pictures.
Okay. Okay. Right. Okay. So very quickly, this is basically what things look like in the low RM regime. So not very interesting. I mean, I think the original version of this movie did indeed move, but as you can see, it's pretty static at the moment. So I think when we imported it to Keynote, it sort of lost its motion. But anyway, this gives you an idea of what the convective state actually looks like. Reynolds number is really too small for me to call it turbulent, so I don't really identify it in a sort of turbulent sense, but it's certainly highly time dependent. And what we see, if we put in a sort of field at low RM, we see initial phase of growth. This is, again, magnetic energy versus time. So this growth occurs when the seed field is expelled into the convective downflow, so that's a brief amplification phase. Then eventually, viscous of Earth, diffusive effects take over, and we get a nice exponential tail down here. So that's straightforward. I'll move on to, again, that's not working. So what about the higher M case at 660? Again, get a very nice initial growth phase here for exactly the same reason. So flux expulsion is producing features at the edges of the convective cells. But then we've got a very long, again, this is kinematic, we've got a very long exponential growth phase over three orders of magnitude. So I think we can be fairly confident here we have a kinematic dynamo. Again, this was going to move, but this is the B squared at the middle layer of the domain, and we can see it's all pretty complicated. So I think it's quite nice there. Right, so moving into the nonlinear regime. What do we get? Well, again, this is slightly higher resolution. Still lambda is 4, slightly smaller value of Rm, 520 now. That's a magnetic parameter number of what, 3.5? And again, plotted this, yet it is still a log linear scale. Get again, what is, if you plot a slope of here, it's again a kinematic phase of growth, or apparently kinematic phase of growth, but we don't actually get properly kinematic behavior. There are actually some local non-linear effects that are beginning to come into play. So the flow is globally very, very similar. I mean, it's still doing what it was doing before, the sort of convective, but locally, so at these sort of points here, where you get these very intense magnetic flux concentrations, we do start to see some evacuation, which is what I'm going to get to next. So there is some very... Yes, exactly. Yeah, sort of here, and here. So you can sort of identify these, hopefully with sort of plots on the temperature.
Let me ask again, how do you define your Reynolds numbers? On the base of depth?
Yes, the base of depth, yeah. With an RMS velocity and a mid-layer viscosity. Okay. So, I mean, what we have in the previous slide is what looks like exponential growth. So you might naively think, well, this is all nice linear evolution. But as I mentioned, if you actually look at these magnetic flux concentrations as they form, what happens is they evacuate pretty rapidly. And so you've got very high magnetic pressure, which forces fluid basically out of the surface regions of the domain. Just to illustrate this process, so this is a plot of minimum density against time, again against the same time units. And so remember, during this phase, we're getting a nice exponential growth, everything looking very nice and well-behaved. But looking at this, minimum density versus time, starts off order 2. By the time you get down here, it's of order 0.1. So you get this really dramatic effect. It's a really inexorable decline in terms of this minimum density against time. So it's certainly a very significant effect. And it's not numerical, it's a physical effect. And it's very much this high magnetic pressure forcing fluid out, leading to this partial evacuation. So what are the implications? Well, numerically, well, there are two sort of important ideas. The first of these is the Alfvén speed, which goes like b divided by root of rho. So where rho gets small and b gets large, the Alfvén speed gets very large. Similarly, the coefficient of thermal diffusion goes like 1 over rho. So again, as rho gets very small, both of these quantities increase very, very rapidly. So we have timescales associated with both thermal diffusion and any kind of Alfvénic disturbances become very, very small. And if we're going to do an explicit time-stepping scheme, which is what I'm doing, critical time step becomes very, very small, and you end up with very, very long integration. So numerically, it's a headache. It really is. I mean, you can...
Is temperature diffusion molecular or effective?
It's DNS, so I mean,
it's constant in some form.
Yes. Well, capital constant, yeah.
Let me, make small remark that in reality, it's proportional just to this, if it's molecular.
You still then have the issue of the Alfvén speed, which would still be getting very large. So, but yeah, it's certainly worth considering.
Because free length path proportional to to perception of interaction. If you calculate it, what is kappa actually?
Well, but it all depends on the material.
If it's normal gases,
no. No, but I mean, if you are in this kind of regions, kappa is actually quite obviously defined, right? So you could have a lot of different. I'm just saying this. It's nothing like saying just that in reality things should be proportional to rho, because what's going on in the plasma is just different.
Well, finish.
Yeah, so I was just going to finish with a very, very quick couple of sort of summaries and conclusions. I mean, one thing I would say is all these things I've done are at high PM, and I think I've hopefully made the point that using DNS, I don't think we can ever, hope at this stage to get into the low PM regime. Just simply available computing resources just can't cope. So I think probably we need to do something clever and theoretical in this case rather than rely upon numerics. I hope I've shown that convective dynamos do work in the high PM regime, so that's fine. Although we have this issue of this partial evacuation, which certainly leads to, a set numerical difficulty, certainly much longer computations than you would otherwise be dealing with. So I've got two sort of possible suggestions that might be a good way to go. So rather than looking at a fully compressible case, perhaps to go for an anelastic approximation. It's very good to, sort of, plenty of people have used anelastic calculations here, so it's very good to sort of get any input on that front as to, you know, how these sort of things might work. Finally, I've got this possible suggestion that perhaps rather than using a uniform mesh, there might be a case to be made for using some kind of adaptive mesh refinement, which would certainly allow us to sort of focus all the resolution upon the magnetic features rather than just globally distributed across the box. So I think those are two possible solutions to the problem.
Can you try to confirm the results of this simulation with the results for incompressible, non-convective simulations for double mesh systems? Do you see some differences in the results?
In terms of the...
You include compressibility and convection.
It's sort of hard now to compare.
Sure, he showed raw, right? Dependence.
Yeah, well, maybe one issue is that Chekhov-Shehin is pushing the issue that the flow is, that the magnetic field has these arch like folding structures.
Yeah. Not so much in this case. It's so anisotropic because of the convective patterns rather than necessarily, because I think Alex uses a sort of more isotropic forcing, doesn't he, in his cases. So pretty much, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the scales are very different. Yeah, the scales are very different, but yeah, it's a reasonable assessment. Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Yeah,
we're not making one. On the numerical issue, it's very hard. You get this thing, everything evacuates.
Yeah.
Talking
about ways to try to do some of the
dynamics implicitly.
Yeah.
Trying to do all the wave dynamics implicitly. Now you had one of the problems with the
alpha
aspect.
Yeah, well, that would get around that. Yeah.
I wonder if it would also get around the other problem, the evacuation, because that's obviously a sounds
problem. Possibly, yeah. I mean,
it's not an easy problem to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
Interaction between depth of the structure and typical horizontal size of the structure.
So depth of the box on the granular scale. So probably easiest illustrated in one of these. So yeah, okay. So typical granular scale is about order one and a half to depth one as well. So it's certainly comparable to the box depth.
I'm going to write on the board mainly and put only the figures on that. So, I've already talked a little bit in different conferences about all these things, so I apologize for those of you who've already listened to it sometimes, but it's going to be more complete and focused on the small-scale dynamo in the end. Right, so I'm going to talk about three things, if I have enough time. Coherent structures in turbulent convection, spectral scaling laws and universality of convective turbulence, and how all these things possibly could have implication for the small-scale dynamo, small-scale convective dynamo. Right, the first thing I want to talk about is something we had already had an argument with Nathan and Igor on that, is thermal winds and coherent structures in thermal convection. Right, so this picture is from Fausto Cattaneo's 2001 paper, where is there any pointer? Where you can see at the surface of that's a temperature plot at the surface of a large aspect ratio boostiness simulation of convection. These small scale granular features on top of which you have these larger energetic structures that actually have an aspect ratio, meaning horizontal size over vertical size, larger than one. Right? This has an aspect ratio 10 to 20, meaning that the box depth is actually very small compared to the width. So, and if you go inside this layer, I don't have a picture of his own simulation there, but you just notice that the granulation scale, which is the boundary layer scale at the close to the top thermal boundary, vanishes, and you just end up with these big features here. Well, visibly, I mean, not really in the spectra. And, well, if you use, like, a cork set going at the surface, you can very easily isolate these large-scale structures, right? Meaning that there's a strong and a strong velocity field that has a slow time scale in the problem. So during my PhD, I did some of this simulation for compressible convection with even larger aspect ratio, where we did not patch box together. This one has an aspect ratio of a little bit more than 40, and a stratification in density, which can't be huge because these were pretty expensive calculations. These are vertical cuts at different times, in which I've been squeezing a little bit just because that is 1 and that's 40. So what you see in that simulation is that you start from a small perturbation, so you have a linearly unstable situation, right? These are the linearly unstable scale, and suddenly, well, it evolves as a network of coherent structures on top of which you also get smaller scale structures. But most of the energy basically lies on scales that have a typical aspect ratio of 5-6.
How do you define coherent
scale? I'm coming to it. Right, so this is time evolution. These are the linearly unstable scales, which are fairly small, which we can sort out from linear theory for the given Rayleigh number and Prandtl number that I have. And you see with time evolution, that's in the middle of the layer this time, and you see these larger and larger structures forming, right? This is very apparent visibly. Right, so if you look at the time evolution of the spectrum of temperature in full line and velocity in full line and temperature in dashed line, you just see this time evolution very properly. This is the peak of the linear instability scale. This grows up originally. All these band of wave numbers is unstable, but these ones are the most unstable ones. And you have a spectrum developing, and the peak of the spectrum shifts to the left, right? Meaning that most of the energy is actually contained in those structures here, which have what k equals 10. This is a horizontal k. And this corresponds precisely to these coherent structures, right? K equals 10 in my unit is basically is also something like several times the box, so the vertical box size, right? And this kind of settles in some form of pseudo steady state, which you can trace by actually looking at the evolution of the integral scale, which is defined as being proportional to E of k over k dk, right? So you actually weight the small k's by the energy, and they actually dominate this quantity. And you can see that you start from, this is a linearly unstable scale, basically, and you end up having energy being contained in these very large eddies, well, very wide eddies, right? Which also says that in all the simulations with a smaller aspect ratio, right, these structures here are more or less relaxed because my box is very wide. But in all the convection simulations with small aspect ratio, you actually constrain the dynamics to small horizontal scale somehow. And that if you actually allow for more space, these structures develop and take more and more space if you allow them to do that. Right, so just to show Nathan that my results are not wrong, this is another paper by Parodi and people like Ed Spiegel, who've been doing the same kind of simulations in boostiness convection for Rayleigh number for the 10 to the 6, and aspect ratio 2 pi, so smaller but slightly larger Rayleigh numbers. This is a vertical map of temperature, so kind of standard picture. And they do have a plot of the integral scale as well in their simulation, right? So first, this is their spectra. So their spectra is basically maximum at 2 pi, so the horizontal size of the box, right? So very wide aspect ratio structures. And the integral scale is going something like 3, right? And the box is 2 pi. So it's basically the same size. All right, so there's another paper by Hartlepp and Busse too that actually produced these structures and looked a little bit at their dependence on Rayleigh number. And they actually, the width increases with the Rayleigh number. So what I want to say here is that these structures are energetic scales, right? And now what we could ask is how do they emerge? Where do they come from? Right, so to do that, I did some attempt, right, which is might or might not be relevant, to look at the spectral dynamics of the flow. So if you go to spectral space and integrate over the vertical direction and look at all the, at the dynamics scale by scale in k space, you end up with this time evolution for energy as a function of k. So that's a transfer function, right, which contains all the nonlinear terms, a forcing function, which contains the buoyancy terms, and a dissipation function, right? So if you go into the pseudo steady states where, or at times where only you see the large scale still growing, what you see is that the dte of k for these scales, which are the mesoscale, the coherent structure scale, is positive here. It's almost steady for all of the scales. This one are slightly decaying. What's important here is that in that budget, what is positive is that these structures are forced by buoyancy. Okay, and what does T of K do? T of K is a nonlinear transfer, the nonlinear cascading terms. And T of K, so the Reynolds stresses, actually take energy from these structures, right? So they do not result from some form of inverse cascade or Reynolds stresses. They do result from the action of buoyancy, right? And so what's going on is a very standard three-dimensional turbulence picture where you force at large scales, you pump energy, you cascade it down by nonlinear terms, and ultimately this T of K is transferred to the small scale where viscosity is actually dissipating them, right? So since we don't have a very high Rayleigh number here, in practice you should have everything separated at higher Rayleigh numbers, so that T of K should be zero in some range. And the integral of T of K over K, since advection conserves energy, the nonlinear terms, should be zero. And this is, you can actually compute this, and this is clearly zero. So there's nothing really different in that sense from a standard 3D turbulence picture.
How do you define unit factor? Is it mechanical energy, or does it include the thermal
heat? It is the kinetic energy here, yes. Kinetic energy. Yeah, so you can also do that. You can.
Well, I think that leads the question to produce a similar graph.
Yes, precisely. It's exactly the same. It works exactly the same way, except that the forcing term here in the temperature equation will come from the V dot grad T naught, right, or V dot grad S naught. Right, so it looks basically like standard turbulence. Right, so another. Interesting, I think, story is to look at the spectral scaling loads in turbulent convection, just to look at the similarities with standard 3D turbulence. So that's a paper by Valsico and Camuzzi, a GIFM paper of 2003, where they actually mimic an experiment with helium, a bottle with aspect ratio 1/2 a cylinder. And they go to, that's to my knowledge, highest Rayleigh number ever reached with simultaneously high Reynolds number, which is 2 × 10⁻¹ⁱ for numerical experiments. And just to make to kind of try to convince you that this thing is okay, they put here all the numbers with a Kolmogorov scale, thermal boundary layer scales, as you can actually predict and compute and compare with their resolution. They have a non-uniform mesh in that direction. Well, it's a numerical experiment. So basically, I think this one is slightly under-resolved, but all the ones up to 10⁻¹⁰, I think, are okay. Right, so what they see is actually fairly interesting. That's 10⁻⁷, right? So they have this kind of plume structures here, where you can see some form of large-scale coherent structures. That's a cut of temperature viewed from the top and at different depths. And now you increase the Rayleigh number, and therefore the Reynolds number, and you see these things, like you have these cells forming, large-scale cells, plus all the shredding that occurs and some turbulent cascade. And it's even more, that's the one at 10⁻¹⁰, that's an intermediate one at 10⁻⁹. Right, so they can clearly very easily isolate some form of mean flow in there and coherent structures, plus all this turbulence. Now, well, they have a fast, much longer time scale than well, I'm coming to it. So the question is, what's the spectrum of this thing, right? Is there any scale separation between all these things, actually? So if you take, so what they did, because they wanted to mimic a real experiment, is that they just stood at some point in the middle or close to a wall and make single point measurements, as people do with hot wires in turbulent convection. And they made a time spectrum, so there's no Taylor hypothesis here, right?
You're talking about taking spectra of coherent structures, but the phase is important. You're losing.
I'm just considering the spectra for the moment. I'm not saying it's not important. Right. So what's the spectrum of this thing? Temperature spectrum, right? That's Rayleigh number equals 10^7 here. And you extend, you increase the Rayleigh number, and you see, of course, the spectrum forming here. So it raises the question of how large you far you have to go just to actually get a decade of something which looks like a real slope, right? That's the first question. The second question is, all the slow motions are also dominating the energy spectrum, right? So it's just more or less like what we had before in the local simulations. Meaning that there's a lot of energy contained in there, and there's no scale separation between the turbulence and the large slow scales, right? It's all a continuum of scale.
Of time scales,
yes. But I mean, right.
But how do you know about quantum? You know, formally, these structures, by the way, in this specific case, of course, we never find real, how to say, stationary coherent structure, because it's not fundamental model. So, but nevertheless, I think if you've got this structure which stay in time without, changing, I think it's impossible in this experiment to find it. Because you, in some sense, you believe that it's random.
Why? You just measure things for a long enough time, right? It's
not the question of enough time on a particular spectrum. Just by you take a square from quadratic calculation from your, how to say, realization, nothing else. It's not enough to take into account phase. First of all, you should average.
Well, I mean, if you want to compute a spectra, you don't take the phase, basically. Whatever
no,
spectra you're considering.
No. It is special study for non-coherent phenomena.
I mean, according to me, E of K is something where you get the modulus, right?
If you have interesting energy, yes. But if you...
But that's what a spectra is.
Yeah. No, it's an energetic spectrum.
Okay. It's a power spectra, right? I'm just talking about that.
Mm, not enough. Yeah, okay, that's true.
Right, so the point is you have this continuum of scales here, and you would like to know when you can get a spectral slope and what this slope is. So for a moment, let's just me focus on what possible slope we could have in that problem. And there are two possibilities, right? So I'm going to write a Kolmogorov equation for convection, basically, quite quickly. So standard Kolmogorov equation is something like S3, which is delta U cube, equals minus 4/5 of epsilon injection rate or dissipation rate in steady state, plus, so you have a forcing, which is a function of R, plus 6 nu d over dr of S2. And S2 is a second order moment, right? So this is a Kolmogorov equation. And what you say in general is, well, if you're in the inertial range, viscosity is not important, and forcing is not important. You assume it to be large scale. So you end up with that balance, which gives you delta U goes like R to the 1/3, right? And therefore, Kolmogorov theorem, right? First point. So what's going on in convection is that you have this thing here, of V, which actually looks like, so there's a coefficient, right? Alpha is a thermal expansion coefficient, G over R squared. And then you integrate delta theta, delta VZ, over R, f prime, sorry, from 0 to r, right? So this is really what the forcing term is for convection. It's just not like a numerical experiment where you would actually put a body force at, k, let's say, k equals 1, right, where you can choose the forcing to be delta in k space. Here you will have a whole spectrum of forcing, right, because all these things depend on the fluctuation, which have all sorts of scales. So you can sort out two theories from that. You have another equation, which is Jagellon equation for the temperature structure functions, which is delta theta squared delta u equals minus 4/3 of n, which is a dissipation of thermal energy now, right, plus, I don't know, there's something, a 2 kappa d over the r of delta theta squared. Delta, did I put, well, u or v, so the same. Sorry, this one is u, yeah, okay. Sorry.
And this is a total velocity.
Yeah, this is...
So you have extracted from this velocity, velocity.
No, delta u is u of x plus r minus u of x.
And
right.
V is a total
velocity. And
every... Yeah, let me maybe in the Is there a production term in the Jagellon equation from theta to d to the gradient?
Yes, there is. Sorry, there is a production term, right? I should put it. Well, the reason I didn't put it is that if when you measure, it's not very important. You just realize it's
I can imagine that the gradient is washed out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Principle.
Yeah, yeah. No, there is one. That's you're right. So, blah blah. Yeah, and plus there are non-homogeneous terms because you have walls. Right, and if you are rigorous, actually, what you have to do, which I did in a paper, is actually projecting all these things. Well, this is actually the spherical average when you make structure functions of the whole Kolmogorov equation, which you can decompose into the spherical harmonics, right? And you could take the anisotropic versions of it. I'm just going to focus on the isotropic version, and I'm not going to talk about anisotropy here, even though it's an important issue. Right, so if you the basic theories that you can do is making dominant balances, right? So the first one is saying S3 is going to balance buoyancy. So delta U cube is going to be to go like delta T, delta V times R, because that's R squared dr here and R squared here. And I'm going to look at the zero sort of version, I'm saying that delta uz is delta u. This is not actually me. This is how this series has been derived. And that's the r here. And then you would say here you have delta theta squared delta u equals, well, goes like r, right? And you mix all these things together, right? And what you're going to get is delta u goes like r to the 3/5, and delta theta goes like r to the 1/5. Right, and this is called Bolgiano theory. This one gives you k to the minus 11/5, and this one gives you k to the minus 7/5 for the temperature. Okay, first possibility. Second possibility is just a standard one, saying that forcing is large scale, and I just balance S3 with epsilon r, and I just use the same scaling for that one, and in that case, I just get Kolmogorov for both delta u and delta theta. Right. So which one of these two theories actually works? And you can also sort out this crossover between these two dominant balance, which occurs at a scale called the Bolgiano length, which in non-dimensional unit you can write as the typical size of the cell in the vertical directions times new cell number to the 1/2, so the heat transport divided by Rayleigh number times Prandtl number to the 1/4. Right, so this thing can be measured in experiments, actually. Right, so we have two theories, and we'd like to know which one works.
Sorry to bring this point up again, but do you ever worry about the effect of any of these large-scale structure flows in the system on the phases between the u and theta? Because you're really, in a sense, the production terms here are really from heat fluxes.
Yeah.
Right, which are, in a sense, not just a question of the fluctuation levels and their scaling, but there's a phase relation between.
Here, I just take the full velocity field and make the exact correlation. So everything is included. Right?
Okay. But I don't, in the scaling argument, I guess.
Oh, no, but the scaling argument is just the only thing that you can do dimensionally, right? I mean,
that could, in a sense, have manifestation of the braiding itself.
Yeah. No, that's. But I'm coming to that because when you look at the experimental results in this Vertico and Camuzzi paper, these are time spectra, velocity field, right? Power spectrum and temperature field. And let's take that. Well, yeah. So that one is for Rayleigh number equals 10 to the 10, and you get the k to the minus 5/3, right? And that's the minus 11/5. So it looks like Kolmogorov theory works quite well for the velocity field. But now if you look at the temperature field, which is here, you would see that the minus 7/5 fits the curve better than the 5/3. Also, 7/5 and 5/3 are very close, so it's not clear. So one of their conclusion is that it's actually very difficult from these things to say if you have 5/3 or 7/5. And here, in some cases, it looks like things are actually mixed, right? You would get the Bolgiano scaling for the temperature and the Kolmogorov scaling for the velocity field, right? But remember, this is all one-point measurements, and you have this mean thermal wind on top of it, right? So when you want to switch from frequency space to k space, for instance, you have to make the Taylor hypothesis. With respect to these mean winds, and these winds are anisotropic, and you are just considering an isotropic version of Kolmogorov equation, all these things. So it might not be that surprising that we don't get the right scalings. What are...
Okay.
Sorry? Yeah, okay, fine. Right, so I've been looking at actually all these terms in a real simulation for, well, small Rayleigh, well, small compared to what Vertico and Camuzzi had done. Because you need a lot of turnover times to integrate the third order structure functions. And that, for that you need to make a compromise. So what's going on in that case? That's first a third order structure function local exponent, like it should be S3 goes like R, right? So the exponent should be 1 if we had the Kolmogorov scaling. And what you just see, if you plot that as a function of R divided by the Kolmogorov scale, well, you don't really get a plateau at any point for that, right? So what's the reason for that? Is it because we are too viscous? And the answer is actually no. Because usually you say, well, you know, you don't have a high enough Reynolds number and you are going to have trouble having slopes. But the reason why you don't get it here is if I look at all these terms, so that's the total, it goes to zero, right? That's the 4/5 term going like that, proportional to R. Okay, that's minus 4/5 epsilon R as a function of R. In units of Kolmogorov scale. This is the viscous term, which is pretty high at small scales, drops down, right? And here is something like one order of magnitude smaller than the 4/5 term at the larger scale at which you can measure things. And this is another term, this dashed line, is actually the forcing term, right? So what you would expect for Kolmogorov turbulence or for, well, the standard picture is you want your forcing to be in this band of scale at very large scales. So that actually the structure function S3, which is here, is going to balance with that line, right? And what you get here is you don't get this balance because actually S3 is just the sum of these two things, and this thing is not negligible, right? So what prevents you from getting a Kolmogorov spectrum for this kind of values of Rayleigh numbers, the fact that you get a very bumpy spectrum, is actually due to the fact that your forcing is distributed over a big broad band of scales. Right? So what you want to do is going to larger Rayleigh number and have this thing becoming more and more focused on the larger scales. Right, so what's the universality of that? It's actually, I think, a beautiful picture here. This is a picture taken from a paper by Castiola on shear turbulence, where you don't get linear instabilities, you just have a shearing box, which is non-linearly unstable, and turbulence gets generated all around, right? And they did exactly the same exercise as they did for convection. So this is for convection, and this is for shear turbulence. 4/5 term, this is my cutoff because they were more turbulent, right? So they had more statistics and on a larger range of scales. So you can just focus on that bit of their graph. So this is the 4/5 term. This is viscosity. This is the 4/5 term. This is viscosity. This is the forcing term coming from the shear, so the cross-correlation, right? This is the forcing term coming from buoyancy, and this is basically S3. So S3 doesn't go like 4/5 epsilon r either in shear turbulence. And the budget, the scale by scale budget in physical space, is just the same for both things, basically, for similar values of the Reynolds number, or slightly small in my case. The phenomenology is exactly the same, right? Which is actually a good indication that, well, when you get all these linear instabilities, ultimately, if you go to large enough scales, you assume that they're going to be concentrated on the large scales, and at some point you should get an inertial range, or some, at least some slope, which is what is seen when you go here, right? When you increase the Rayleigh number. Right, so that was just the point. I just want to make a quick final point now on what are the implications for the small scale dynamo, if you give me just 5 minutes. Right, so we know that there is an issue with respect to large PM versus low PM in that problem, right? And in particular in the case of convection, we can ask, well, do we actually deal with something which looks like standard turbulence, 3D turbulence forced at large scales? Or is it something completely different? Does the magnetic field is going to be space filling, or is it going to be located in these downward plumes? What's the role of these coherent structures that you don't have in 3D homogeneous turbulence? And so that's partly why you do these kind of things with convection, to look at how the scale by scale budget works if it looks like real turbulence. So we know that there is this curve as RE versus RM. So I took the latest version from Alex Shikoshin's recent paper, where the Reynolds number based on your MS velocity is quite, the critical one is quite low at large PM and suddenly increases as PM goes to 1. I took that from a talk from 2004 from Fausto, because he never actually published this data as a function of PM in a proper journal. So, well, just to show that when you decrease PM here, even for quite large RM, you don't get dynamo action for convection, so you end up with having the same kind of behavior, although there's no such curve available. And that's another recent result coming from MRI dynamo simulations, meaning shearing box with no net magnetic flux, where you need to have some form of dynamo action related to MRI in a Keplerian regime. This is a paper by Sébastien Froment and John Papaloizou, where they just kind of see more or less the same critical curve. Here they have dynamo and here they don't have it. So until now they were only able to get dynamo for PM equals 2, and I think now Fausto has something in Tellequet flow for PM equals 1, or maybe 0.5, I'm not completely sure, but he has massive resolutions. And this RE and RM are just based on the shears, they're not RMS values. So, but I mean, the trend is basically the same. So this just all leads us to consider whether or not this is a unified problem, and whether this is a universal problem, right? So my guess would be that at large PM, where the spectrum goes, of velocity goes like that, right? You force at all these scales, which can be broadband or delta in K, depending on of whether you have a linear instability, a subcritical MRI, a shear, or whatever. And then your magnetic field grows like that. And we know that the viscous scales play a very important role in generating the field here. But if you are properly developed, the forcing and the viscous scale are supposed to be separated, and the viscous scale are supposed to be independent of the forcing. So in some sense, this part of the curve here, I would say, should be universal and not depend on the kind of mechanism that's actually forcing the turbulence originally. Now the problem emerges of knowing what's going to happen when suddenly you have your velocity spectrum like that. You also have your forcing in a band of scales, right? That's K and E of K. And suddenly you have to put your magnetic spectrum in the middle, right? So what's going on if there is some overlap between the forcing scales and these coherent structures, for instance, in convection? Or if you are in a more extreme regime where you would have something like this, and then now your forcing is just distributed at very, very large scales, and you could assume that your magnetic spectrum is still lying there, or maybe, I don't know, here. I don't have any answer to that. I just want to point out that the details of the forcing here and the large-scale structures might be extremely important for the small-scale dynamo to work at low PM, which is also kind of what Steve and Fausto are saying in another paper. Yeah, OK. Just one final sentence, right? So I just want to point out that maybe the low PM dynamo may not be universal because of this issue. Yeah, that's all.
Yes? Okay. Put it. I'd like to point out that collaborative theory was developed not for the total velocity, but for rotation. So here, if this is a total velocity, then here there are several terms. And I'd like to pay attention that in this problem, not in this problem, in the program of climate change, there was brilliant talk by Mikhail Schwarz, his experiment, with Richard Palkovich and with his PhD student. It was discussed the problem of 2D turbulence. And just he demonstrated that if he excludes from the experimental data mean flow, he immediately resolved the puzzle which exists with the spectrums in 2D. So this is this paper now is in a wiki and can be found there. And this is a very interesting example.
I mean, there's no real theory here. You just write the equations,
yeah,
right?
And
that's
I'd like to say that these velocity differences, certain model for the velocity differences for in Kolmogorov theory was for fluctuations, not for the total velocity.
No, but you can derive this equation for the total velocity without making any assumption.
Okay.
Did I understand you correctly that you observed in convection effects that for the velocity that's more like 7/5 for the temperature?
Yeah.
And are you explaining that in terms of the
forcing term together which of the two scalars?
No, that's something I didn't have time to look at. LB is the Bolgiano length in all these things, in all experiments, all numerical experiments and all real experiments, is actually of the size or comparable to the size of the box, which means that there's no possibility to get Bolgiano scalings, right? Because this is supposed to be at scales larger than that. So I think the reason why they get something which is difficult to measure is because they have this issue of measuring time spectra somehow. And when you want to convert to and compare with the predictions done in physical space, you somehow have to make this transformation with the Taylor hypothesis,
yeah.
And also take into account that things are anisotropic, right?
That has nothing to do then with the overlapping forcing function.
The slope of the spectrum. I'm not saying this has to do with the forcing function. I think the forcing function is important to explain why you don't get Kolmogorov for Rayleigh numbers, which are only mild, right? Because the forcing in that regime is still very important at every scale. But I don't think there's any possibility for Bolgiano scalings.
First of all, I would like to stress that this equation, which of Kolmogorov and after that of Yaglom, it is equation for correlation functions in homogeneous turbulence, which depend just on one difference of two coordinates. Difference. It's true just for homogeneous turbulence. If we've got coherent structure, it means that we've got non-homogeneous structure in some sense. So its analysis is very questionable. But let me...
You can add non-homogeneous terms in that equation.
It will be totally another equation with another result. Okay, let us start nevertheless. Okay, let us start from the first. It is example of different convection. I would like to stress that today I will speak just about convection. No magnetic field, because in some sense, my feeling that it's very hot topic, all this stuff. It is three examples of convection. This is atmospheric convection, this solar convection, pay attention how it's similar. And the third is laboratory convection. This pillar-like structures, it is so-called hexagons, And the deep difference between, say, this more or less hexagonal-like structure and this one, it's a ratio. Roughly speaking, depth twice smaller than the typical horizontal scale of these structures. And for atmosphere, we know for sure this ratio, roughly speaking, 4. Of course, you can find another ratio because it in the long run, in long time, for very long time, it all this picture is not stationary. It changed. But nevertheless, dominant ratio, according to meteorological observation, 4. Okay, and I would like to stress that all this work was made with my normal collaborator, Igor Rogachevsky, and other people from our laboratory, and again, Sergei Zelitinkevich from now from Finland is one of, he was involved in this, all this stuff. Okay, several, what I would like to discuss, basically coherent structure, result of observation, which I mentioned yet, and mechanism, possible mechanism of formation of this coherent structure. We've got even, what maybe I will be enough brave to say, we've got some similar to theory, at least linear theory of this phenomenon. And I would like to discuss briefly experimental study, what we find in laboratory. We observed this example. Let us say that this is an interesting phenomena that we can observe practically all the time. It is just cloud cells over Atlantic Ocean, so it's normal, nothing special. And again, this is picture of from several granulation. But today we speak about hydrodynamics, and so the very similar picture people observe in meteorology, it's just cross section, which and interesting phenomena that it is mean field. Pay attention how it's well organized. And this is our result from laboratory. Unbelievable similar. Advantage of meteorology and laboratory, we can sit in two systems. Not to look from distance as we've got in astronomy. So we can, it's amazing how mean field in meteorology and mean field in laboratory similar. Okay, several words about equation. Of course, it's standard equation, second law of Newton with standard terms. Of course, in view of geophysics problem and astronomical problem, we should take into account rotation. But in our laboratory study, because typical time of experiment just several hours, we normally drop this force. And if we study thermal phenomena, we should take into account equation of temperature equation. If we speak about magnetic field, we should add induction equation, but again, I will drop in this lecture all this, or this presentation all this stuff. Yes, you're right. But it's an important step that we use for description potential temperature. Okay, I'll try, we'll be very short. Okay, after averaging, we find similar equation. And let us discuss very briefly our experimental setup. You're familiar, this is cooling and heating. And we use PIV system in order to observe this. Turbulent convection before averaging, after averaging. And it's interesting example of what actually happened. On this is average picture, and now I will demonstrate you instantaneous picture. No, how to say, any sign of this nice coherent structure. But after 150 pictures, 120 pictures average, we find this very well organized structure. Okay, what's the explanation? The main idea that standard Boutonniere frontal model is not enough. What we find that standard heat flux, which normally we discuss in large eddy simulation or in simple numerical model, which proportional gradient of temperature, is not enough. We find extra terms, and these extra terms you can see on this slide. These terms describe direct influence of velocity on large-scale flux. Suppose we've got initial large-scale flux in vertical direction. If we impose large-scale cell, what actually happened, the distribution of line of large-scale flux. First term you can see on this picture how it works. It just take each line of flux and just put in another place, because it is not the same situation in molecular transport. It's similar, it's real thermic, it's real piece of mass. And we have got concentration of this flux in places where we've got convergence of large scale velocity. As a result, we produce hot spot. Hot spot means we've got initial extra buoyancy force. As a result, we've got some kind of large scale instability. It's another mechanism which associated with another term. Roughly speaking, what actually happened, it is a large scale cell a little bit rotate flux. And this is a result of simplest linear analysis of this instability, and we find that it's not the same as Rayleigh mode. Comparison with Rayleigh, it is equation, Rayleigh-like equation, and we've got extra term, which for small difference in temperature, which we observe, it is this term is dominate, and we've got totally another picture of stability curve. This is our curve, which concentrate on ratio 0.5, while standard picture of Rayleigh concentrated on 1. And we think its explanation was why dominant mode has ratio 1/2. If we our advance, we can measure directly what effective coefficient we have got in system, and we can even find effective Rayleigh number. And this Rayleigh number really small, not enough to get in Rayleigh approximation convective picture. So for large scale stuff in frame of Rayleigh approximation, is possible to understand. But because in our calculation we find that this value much more smaller, say 98 just, it may be explanation why we observe this nice regular picture. And another very interesting feature that we haven't this homogeneous thermal structure, and what we've got concentration temperature in two columns, this cold column, hot column, and what actually happened, this large scale structure simply rotate flux, turbulent flux, or it's a gradient, and turbulent flux concentrate in these two columns too. So in this place we measured turbulent flux, it's very, this flux is very low. And basically in this region we've got shear-like turbulence. Okay. what's the issue here? So I'm very close to several words about setup. We had, of course, the additional installation in order to find mean temperature field. And what we do in addition, we put these two grids on both sides. And so we can switch on grids, and as a result, to destroy totally this large-scale circulation. If we destroy large-scale circulation, we immediately restore normal gradient of temperature. And this situation, central part now is not isothermic. This is profile, this is the last slide, profile of temperature without grids, oscillating grids, and with we've got very simple pronounced temperature gradient. And we believe that in this situation, if frequency is not so high, this situation more or less similar to a Delice turbulent convection. And but if we've got zero vertical gradient, it means that this is convection with very pronounced coherent structure.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Right.
The effect in a sense, the flux produced by the interaction of the heat flux with the secondary flows.
Redistribute better.
Redistribution. Okay, so that's just so we understand where the zoology of that is. That's a fourth order effect then.
Why fourth
the
order?
Flux is second order in fluctuation level,
mm-hmm.
and then secondary flow, presumably, is.
Let me disagree with you. You're right if we speak, say, for example, for stable stratification, because we've got extra source of turbulence. And of course, velocity, it is first order, temperature effect is second order, and blah, blah, blah. But for convection, order of temperature fluctuation and velocity is the same.
Right. So
all this stuff second order.
What I'm trying to say, what order in fluctuation is you? Is that some sort of secondary mode, like the big roll in the box, or is that a large scale convection?
I understand your question. It depends first in nonlinear regime on position,
right.
First. And what the crucial, at least according to observation, horizontal gradient. If you've got horizontal gradient, you've got...
It
changed drastically. Because, let me, 1 minute, I would like to demonstrate some very important contribution in our rheology. I hope... pay attention to this stuff. It's proportional. This contribution to flux proportional to theta square directly. If you've got some extra source of theta square fluctuation as horizontal gradient, you can get very large effect of turbulent flux, much larger than we normally can get with practically zero vertical gradient. It's a crucial point, all this stuff. Huh? But again, you can see velocity proportional to theta dash and flux proportional to theta dash, all these values for the same order. Gradient equals zero.
I'm talking about the big U and the big W.
And U is the same order of this, the same order, all stuff of the same order.
So it's fourth order, then. Okay.
Okay.